is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women, people, in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. I am delighted to introduce tonight's speaker. She's somebody that I have over many, many years gotten little snippets here and there of her story from her awesome sharing. And I have always, when I see her now and then, it's like, yeah, I too must have this thing that makes one so obviously happy, joyous, and free, always with her arms outstretched to help anybody she can. And I'm going to turn you over to Mary B.
Thank you, Ala. I tucked a 20 in your purse before the meeting for that, so I appreciate that. Thank you. And thank you for Lisa and Tim asking me to tell my story. It's been a while since I've done it, but I think it's really important to do from time to time because it's always a good review. Like Ila said, my name is Mary, and I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. My sobriety date is July the 20th, 1987, and in July I picked up 36 years. So, you know, we can have a lot of conversations about sitting in a lot of meetings for a lot of rooms and listening to a lot of drunks over a long time. You know, we can have a lot of conversations about why we're alcoholics, you know, and particularly if you stick around long enough and you watch the trends in America, you know that we all go through like decades of trauma. You know, like the 80s were like the drug addict. Every Hollywood star was a drug addict or an alcoholic, or then, you know, the 90s had their own particular psychological disorder, and the 2000s have their own thing. But, you know, if you stick around in these rooms long enough, you hear a lot of debate about why I'm an alcoholic, why I'm a drug addict, why I'm this, why I'm that. Some people tell you it's trauma. You know, this is bullshit. The reality of the situation for this alcoholic, why I'm an alcoholic, is because I'm an intrinsically inherent, dishonest person. That's the bottom line. And I've lied to myself and the world for my whole life. That's why I still come to meetings. And I tell this story. I grew up here in Atlanta. I'm the youngest of four. My mother has told me on more occasions than I can count that if I was the last one. So my mother has told me on several occasions, if you had been first, there would not have been any more. That just kind of gives you an idea. But I tell this story because it's so reflective of, you know, long before I drank and long before I did these terrible things that, you know, you have to do a four-step about and confess and all this kind of stuff, that really just boils down to, you know, what is your problem? And this is that story. When I was in the second grade, I got this. We lived, our school was right here, and we lived on the corner, like literally there was the hill and the crosswalk, and that's where we lived. So in the second grade, our PE period was like the second to the last period of the day. So I got this great idea. Every alcoholic understands that great idea thing. So I decided, after studying and watching this, I decided that whoever the last kid was in line held the chair. And you know, when you're in second grade, holding the chair is like super important. So conning somebody into holding the chair in front of you is really not all that difficult. So I talked this little kid into carrying the chair in front of me. And so this was on a Thursday. So he carried the chair in. I ducked down below the windows. You know, all those 1950s schools had the long windows. And then, you know, you duck down. I ducked down, went home. Cool. Okay, I did it. Like, you know, this is cool. So, of course, you know, we never do anything once. So I repeated that on Friday. And then what the hell? You know, let's just get bolder and let's do it again. So I did it again on Monday. However, I got really bold and I decided in our neighborhood, I grew up over near North DeKalb Mall, and in our neighborhood there was a little pharmacy called Cook's Pharmacy. And Dr. Cook knew everybody that lived in the neighborhood. So about 2 o'clock, I decided to go down to Cook's, I'm going to get some candy, and I'm coming back. So on my way down there, I happen to walk through the neighborhood, and there's this old lady in her yard, and she looks up at me, and she's like, oh, girl, isn't that kind of early? Aren't you supposed to be in school? And I said to her, my mother is very sick, and I need to go to Cook's and get her some medicine. I mean, just came right out. I didn't even have to think that. Hit Cook's drugstore, got my score, heading home. I'm good to go. Well, you know, consequences are something that we generally do not want to consider. And the next thing I know, there's a knock on the front door. And it happens to be Mr. Anderson, my elementary school principal. Remember, I was number 4, and he had had the rest of us. So he was not real surprised. So he calls my mother, and the phone conversation goes something like this. He goes, hey, Ms. Williams, this is Mr. Anderson. My mom was just like, hey, Mr. Anderson, how are you? He said, guess where I'm standing? And my mother's thinking, I don't know, Mr. Anderson, where are you standing? And he goes, I'm standing in your kitchen. And my mom is like, Mr. Anderson, why are you standing in my kitchen? Yeah, and there was, you know, there was a whole lot of consequences that came as a result of that. But I tell that story, it's cute and it's funny, but it's the reality of my inherent dishonesty and ability to lie when the time worked out quickly and easily. And basically, that has been a part of my life for a long time. That's part of the core. That's who I am. And that's why I still come to meetings to work on that. My, I will qualify, but essentially here's the deal. The big book talks about women alcoholics, and it's pretty clear. Generally what we do is we do, like, at least in my case, I hit the cliff and just jumped off. There was no point to go down or negotiate or think about. I just, like, cliffed that. Just. There was not a lot of alcohol in my home. It was, my parents didn't drink a lot. My grandmother was kind of a teetotaler, so it was just not a big deal for us. So for me, my first drink was this. I was in the 10th grade with Kelly Merritt. And her dad, she drove one of those Chevrolets. You remember the ones that had, like, they were two-tone. That's when the Chevrolet, the Caprice Classic got boxy instead of round, and it was two-tone. And she stole beers out of her dad's cabinet, whatever. So she told me that morning. So you have beers that have been rolling around in the trunk of a car all day and all evening. And we went to a football game. And then after that, we're driving around drinking these beers. And the reality of the situation is we're like, we have freaking made it. This is cool. This is it. Hell yeah. It doesn't get any better than this, you know. And I was, it was beautiful. It was a beautiful thing. And so, you know, back to my nature, if one's good, 10's always better. Why stop now? As a result of that, I you know, my drinking career and drugs are part of my story, so if that offends anybody, please call your sponsor and pray for me, because I'm going to talk about it. But, you know, this was in the 80s, right? So powder cocaine was like the huge thing, and so everybody was doing that. And I found, well, actually, quickly what happened was I just jumped in, and I found a guy that was about 10 years older than I was, and I was teetering on being a senior in high school. And, well, let me back up really quickly. The summer before my senior in high school, I went to see my brother, who's 10 years older than I am, in California, and went to stay with him for a couple months. This is where I learned a very important alcoholic lesson. Because I was started dating this guy, and his wife was in the Air Force, so I started dating this airman, right? And I'm like 17. So all of a sudden, the airman's getting in real big trouble because somebody ratted to his squad commander that I was underage, and now all of a sudden, you know, I just got my heart broke. So my sister-in-law's cousin, you know, I was devastated. So my sister-in-law's cousin picked me up and was like, come on. So, of course, we did, you know, what any good alcoholic who's in the throes of heartbreak and their life shredded apart by the love of their life lost. We drank peach schnapps and watched An Officer and a Gentleman. That was my first lesson, and you can drown your shit, and this will be good. After that, I headed back home. My senior year went something like this. My best friend and I, first period was meant for breakfast. So we were at the Waffle House because we had a small economy. I'm a capitalist. We need to support the local economy. Our particular waitress needed good tips. So we felt an obligation as a proud American to go support our Waffle House waitress, Elizabeth. Second period, generally we went to wake up TC, her boyfriend, and drink along the way. Third period, I like Mr. Bird, so I felt it was necessary to show up at his class. Fourth period, was lunch. We gotta go. We gotta go eat lunch. Fifth period was chorus, and I was the vice president of the chorus, so I had a moral responsibility to show up and do my part. Sixth period, we might stay and we might not, all depending upon, you know, what was going on at the time. Well, DeKalb County and I had, you know, some pretty serious issues and arguments about opinions about whether I should be there or not. So, like any good alcoholic, I played this game, and for fourth period, they finally sequestered me in the attendance office for a period of time so they could at least keep an eye on me. And I got a great idea. Now, see, I'm still really mad about myself about this because I discovered an economic opportunity in which at that time in our lives, there was this is old school, so there was a pass and a stamp. And if you had Mr. Kosmarski's stamp on the hall pass, you could check in and out. Well, after about 2 weeks, there was this huge rash of unexplained check-ins and check-outs because I'd been selling hall passes for like a dollar pack. See, I should have been like $10. I could have got it at that time. I didn't pay enough attention to Mr. Bird's economics class to really understand what my profit margin could have been because I could have made a fortune, but I didn't. Basically, it ended up like that. They said, you will either leave this school, we will throw you out, or you will go to open campus, and you will end that way. So I did, and I barely scraped by. I did get to walk on my class, which is important. But after that, it was balls to the wall. I moved out. I moved in with my druggy boyfriend who lived in Clarkston, who's about 10, 15 years older. Who the hell knows anymore? And I moved into alcoholic paradise. I mean, if you're going to do it, do it. And here's the thing. Matt was a trust fund baby, right? So he had a house. All the bills were paid, and so, but Matt's obligation, his dad said, look, you've got to do one thing, you've got to have a job. So Matt did what he was supposed to do and got a job at the liquor store in Clarkson. So when you listen to some alcoholics in these rooms talk about liquor cabinets, no, that's not our way. We had an entire wall built, shelves, ceiling to floor, all the way across, 3 and 4 bottles deep. You want to talk about drinking yourself to death? just jump in the pool and drown in it. I did get a job at Stone Mountain in the cash control office. And the cool part about it is you have to get a lie detector test to do that. And so the lie detector guy that gave me the test, he was like, I sit there and I'm just shaking like a leaf. And every time I like just breathe, it just goes, everything goes, and I'm like, and the poor guy was like, look, we're never going to get through this. He goes, listen, honey, here's the key. Just breathe. Just in your head, go in, out, in, out. Pass that thing with flying colors. No problem. You know, and beautifully enough, when you have people that love you and support you in the right positive way, Matt supported my career choice at the cash control at Stone Mountain Park, so he would pack me a lunch because I worked at night by myself. And I printed all the paychecks for Stone Mountain Park and all the others. So Matt would, like, pack me a lunch, right? So in that, I've got, you know, enough cocaine just to, you know, keep you going through your shift, right? And if you understand this, there's a very delicate balance that most that we understand that the rest of the world doesn't understand. It takes experience and time to be able to find that fine balance of enough booze to keep you from tweaking and enough cocaine to keep you from being shit-faced. That takes time and practice to get that balance right. And it takes a lot of time and practice on a very consistent basis. So I did that, and then you know you're in trouble when on a Sunday morning, not your boss, not your direct supervisor, not your direct supervisor's boss, not your boss's boss, but the head of the department of Stone Mountain Park comes in on Sunday morning at 5:30 in the morning and fires you, you know you are in deep, deep shit. I left that morning and I had that desperation. See, here's the thing about it is we all get here in different ways, but there is one feeling that everybody in this room knows. And you know, it's almost like Chris Christopherson wrote a song about it or something. Sunday morning coming down. The sun is coming up. It's potentially the summer and a beautiful day. And you feel nothing. Absolutely nothing. And you can't. One more snort or one more drink or one more anything is not going to fix this and not going to change it. Because completely on the inside, you're dead. It doesn't fucking matter anymore. Well, it turns out my dad and I have the same birthday, and so that morning I got fired, and we were going to have a big birthday celebration party, and you have to understand at that time, treatment centers were like on every corner, and it was every treatment center in the world. You could go to the Cadillac Treatment Center, they would like give you massages, and you could swim in the pool, there was an array of treatment centers available. And my mother had, she was kind of black belt Al-Anon, she had gotten involved in another 12-step program because my dad had some issues. And so she was very much into the whole, you know, tough love thing. So we went and celebrated my dad's birthday, and we all sit down as family together. And now, and also there was a very violent experience that had happened the day before where I really could not go back to Matt's house because he almost killed me, and a bottle of beer saved my life. So I'm kind of desperate and have nothing left. So my mom, this is when interventions were really big. So we go to dinner, we sit down in the den, and we have this, and all of a sudden, I'm like, got the keys, headed out the door, and my mom's like, you need to sit down, we need to talk. Never in my life, and y'all know this, if you ever hear anybody say those four words, we need to talk, is never good, ever, 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 ever. So my mom, my sister's there, my brother-in-law, my brother, my dad. My mom pulls up this little case, unzips it, pulls out a straw, a razor blade, a mirror, this little package that has this little white stuff in it. She's mad. And really, honestly, y'all, and I still believe this thing, she was more pissed off about the pouch because it was hers and I had stolen it from her than she was about the stuff in it. And what she said is basically, here was the deal. It was like, okay, here's the deal. You have 24 hours to decide. You can get help, and if you choose to get help, we will help you. If you choose to not get help, you have 24 hours to get your shit, get the hell out, and don't call. Ever. Okay. So funny enough, my brother saved my life that night. Later, there's a funnier part to that story. We just walked around the neighborhood. He's like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And I'm like, you know, hell. Yeah, I'm better not going to keep me. I'll go, whatever it was. So I packed my stuff in a laundry basket the next day, and we go to treatment. Now, you have to understand, we talked about treatment centers, right? So I went to a place called Straight. And at that time, Straight was a hardcore, hold you by the belt loop, break the spirit. You didn't talk. You didn't do jack shit. You had to earn every single thing. They held you by the belt loop when you went in the bathroom. The only time there was not another set of eyes on you was when you were taking a shower and your old comer was on the other side of that shower curtain. If you wanted to shave your legs, you had to say, hey, could you watch me shave my legs? It was very much at that hole, we will break you. There were people that stood at the door. It was an old A&P warehouse, and there were people that stood at the door with a chair. And if people ran, you had full permission to use the chair. I have seen a four-point restraint. It's not pretty. So I go. Love can be a very interesting thing. The way that it worked is that all the phasers, that's what you're called, a phaser, because you had to work your way up to first phase. All the phasers sat on, Friday night was meeting night, and all the phasers sat on one side of the room facing the family, okay? You were not allowed to talk, but for the first 14 days, because you had to earn that privilege, so the microphone was passed to the parents. And when your parents got the microphone, you stood up. Now, there's 200 people in this room. You stood up, and they stood up. So my first Friday night there, the microphone goes around, and you can't say anything, because trust me, if you say something, we're going to have review afterwards, and it's bloody and ugly, and your character will be assassinated to a shred. So my mom gets the microphone and she's like, you know, honey, I love you so much and I know you can do this and I have all this faith in you and we're praying for you and da da da. You just all that mom stuff, right? My dad gets the microphone and my dad goes, I'm paying the bill, I hope you do something, and passes it on. Okay. Alrighty then. So I spent 9 months in Straight, and I never got to the place. You got to, you had to get a fifth phase before you could go to a meeting. You had to memorize the steps. Not that that applied it. You understood how to apply them. But I left it early because my dad was like, I'm over this. The way that it worked is we had a base, and you lived in people's homes. So you could change homes at any point in time. You could be like, yo, Williams, you're going to the Johnson's house tonight. Oh, okay. So you never knew where you were. You were always off kilter and always off track. So you just kind of went with the flow. And my dad was like, I'm tired of having people in the house. So I think you've got 9 months under your belt. I think you're good. Do you want to get out? Hell yeah, I want to get out. I'm done. But I understood something. I'd never been to a meeting. Because I was a cop-out, and I left early, I was completely disconnected from the people that I had gotten sober with, so I didn't know anybody. In the meantime, I had lost my driver's license for point suspension. I don't know if they still do that, but, you know, my good alcoholic was like, cool, yeah, I can get two more speeding tickets before I lose my license. So I had something like 20 points in about a 7-month period of time, so the state of Georgia was like, no, that's mine. You can't have that. And I didn't know what to do. I knew I could not do this on my own. But I had nobody that was in my world that understood what I had just lived through. So I picked up the phone and I called the number to Alcoholics Anonymous. And for those that do or do not know him, Big George answered the phone, and he had the sexiest voice, and I was like, oh, shit, that's AA, hell yeah, okay, cool. My dad drops me off at the visiting room, and that was the longest but the shortest walk I have ever made. There's 10 steps to get in there. I knew nobody. And God did for me what I could not do for myself, because God puts us in places where we need to be when we don't know. That's one of those things that's really important. And I showed up at the Biskin Room, and at that time, the Biskin Room at that time had a recovery program where somebody could go sober up, and you could sit with a wet one for 3 days. Girls stayed with girls, and guys stayed with guys for obvious reasons. So I just showed up. I understood, I had memorized those, but I had no idea what that meant. But they told me, just come back. Just come back. Where the hell y'all think I'm going? I don't know anybody else. And, of course, I met a guy. And we had a passionate and wonderful newcomer relationship. Today we are friends still. After all the time, we about killed each other because we were two children trying to have a sober relationship, and neither one of us was over about the emotional level of about an 11-year-old. So it was rather passionate, but it was there. He taught me some very important things. He taught me how to stay sober. He taught me how to go to meetings. I'd never been to a meeting before. None. Had 9 months of sobriety. Had never been to a meeting. Had no idea. Had no idea. But the people that God planted me amongst were very important. Because what happened was this, is this was old school AA. And these guys were, half of them lived under the bridges. They were old drunks that did not tolerate bullshit. And here I come bebopping in there 18 years old. And I'm like, hello, here I am. And they're like, honey, they were like, you're cute, just sit down. And they were harsh, and it was good. And that's some of the things that concern me today about how AA in some respects seems to have changed. My first sponsor, I asked her to sponsor me, and I asked her for her number, and Jan gave me her number, and then I said, do you want my number? And she goes, no. Why? I was like, well, just in case you wanted to call me or something. And she was like, honey, I don't want what you have. Wow. Okay. That was real clear. I was real clear then where I fit in the... They said things like, if you're under 6 months of sobriety, shut up and don't share in a meeting because you have nothing to say and you are just sharing the mess. And we got plenty of that. So until you get a message, shut up. Okay, I can do that. There was a very different tone and tenor, and essentially what I was taught was your sobriety is your responsibility. And if your sobriety is shitty, that shit's on you. If you're miserable and you're stuck and you're crying and you can't get out of it, work some steps, read the book, do something, but don't start crying about this is my sponsor's problem and she's not doing the right thing and bullshit. There's been a trend for the last several years that I don't understand because it wasn't, and I can only share with you I can only share how I got sober. So there's been this trend that I've noticed in the last 10 years about, hey, well, my sponsor won't go with the book with me. My sponsor said, can you read? I said, yeah, I did graduate from the downtown. I did do. By the skin of my teeth, but I did do it. She goes, good, here's a book, go read it. If you have any questions, call me. So, but what I will recommend is that your ass needs to go to one speaker meeting, one big book study, one literature, and one step study, and two discussion meetings every week. No one comprehended that somebody would read the big book to you unless you couldn't read, that'd be different. But I needed to get the collective experience of 50 alcoholics and their perspective on the Big Book and how it worked for them instead of one. I do not do that with a sponsee today. I will not do that with a sponsee today. Because if I do that, you're going to get Mary Benfield's version of the Big Book, and I'm not telling you that's probably not, it's probably not all that healthy. There are some pages I would rather skip. The point is that if you're sobriety and you're not willing to take responsibility for it, I was told you get drunk, that shit's on you. Don't come crying us. Okay. The way that we got sober is, you know, and then there was this trend about, man, you had to have all the steps done by the time you were, what time you had a year. You know, shit, that's ridiculous. Because the reality of the situation is, you know, sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly, there's a reason they write that in the book, because some of us just comprehend going to meetings for like a year. Oh, you want me to come here every day? You want me to call you? Okay. That took, sometimes takes us 6 months to figure out, oh, every single day, like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, every day. Yeah, every day. Okay. And I think what it was impressed upon me is those steps on the wall, you will do them a million times. So understand what they are. I was told, get a God. We don't care who it is. Don't care. And don't want to know. And don't you dare sit your ass in a meeting and start preaching, because nobody gives a shit. As long as you're the power greater than yourself, ain't you, you're good. But in this room and in this fellowship, what and who you believe in is not relevant, and we don't want to know. That gave me a lot of freedom, because that God thing had to, it's changed a lot. As I've stayed sober, it's amazing. God got a lot bigger. His ability to do things got a lot bigger. The more I would let one piece, like, okay, you take this. I don't keep this, because I'm still enjoying this. And I am alcoholic, so guess what? Until the pain outweighs the pleasure, I will play on the playground. Hello. And then that thing gets unmanageable and painful and awful, and I'm like, okay, God, you got to take this, because this is nuts. So my experience is that I have worked those steps 1,000 times. I did them the first time slowly. What I was told is, if you're not sure if you're one of us, if your living experience has not told you that you're powerless and your life is unmanageable, go get more experience until you're convinced. Hope you don't die, but go get some more experience. Because if you're not convinced, you're going to play. And you're probably going to hurt people in the process, because they're watching you play. So go do it. Get it done. Get convinced. Then come back. And I've heard this thing. I had this sponsee call me the other day, and she said something about, well, when do I do my first step? I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? When do you do your first step? Do you understand your powerless over alcohol? Yeah. Is your life unmanageable? Yeah. Check. Move on to two. There's a step where we get the paper out and a pen, and it ain't one, and it ain't two, and it ain't three, it's four. And it's four for a reason. Because I could not look at all that stuff when I first got sober. God Almighty, I needed to have a God in my life. I needed to have some people in my life. I needed to know I was loved, or at least y'all tolerated me before I could look at that shit. And I didn't get confused that it wasn't a confession. I'm not Catholic, so the whole confession thing scares the shit out of me. But, you know, my fourth step was not a confession. My fourth step was, if there was a reason, it's an inventory. What works? What doesn't work? What needs to be done? What needs to be thrown away? What needs to be cut out? What are your patterns of behavior? When this happens, you do this, and then you do this, and somebody else does this, and before you know it, you fucked up your life completely. Maybe we should stop the ball before it rolls all the way down the hill, because it doesn't have to. If you look at yourself, and you've understood that, hey, jealousy is a defect of character. Now, that defect of character manifests itself through your shortcomings in what ways? Well, all of a sudden, if I start getting all critical and talking about, you know, she ain't got so-and-so and so, and they think they're so-and-so and so, that ain't about them, that's about me, because I'm the one eating up with jealousy. That's my side of the street to clean. Because, again, I'm responsible for my own sobriety. And if it's shitty, that's on me. So, quickly, because, you know, it always goes quickly, for at least where the semantics go, I got involved early, right? They say get involved, so I got involved. And my first job in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was at the Biscayne Room, and I did the food for the dances. Let me tell you something. Alcoholics are the most bitchinest, ungrateful, shitty, critical, ain't nothing right. You got a $100 budget to feed like 500 people in a dance. They've been dancing for 3 hours. The food left a long time ago. There's only water left and they're bitching, right? And you're just like, jeez. Well, this one particular dance, the natives were restless. It was about 11:30. We had an hour to go. The food was gone. The drinks were gone. The cook machine was running out. And I'm like, oh, shit, they're probably going to roast me. And this man, who I knew, this man walked in, and he had a ham, like a whole ham.
Oh, yeah.
So, as a result, I got a ham that night, and a little while later, I got a husband out of that deal. Alcoholic relationships are beautiful things, right? And sometimes boy AA meets girl AA, and they have three kids together, and then things don't always work out, and there are other problems and other complications that happen. And so he and I divorced, and right after we divorced, he was diagnosed with lung cancer and died about a week after his diagnosis. So you want to talk about how you learn in this program and when this program, the rubber meets the road, is you find the spiritual strength to look at three little faces and say these words, Daddy died this morning. Y'all saved my life through that. Because Jerry been sober a long time. His name is on the Biscayne Room, all gone to glory. But we ended up, after the funeral, there's a bunch of Biscayne that goes down to stay in Panama City for time at the beach. And the timing was perfect, so we packed up after the funeral and headed to the beach. And I woke up that next morning terrified. And I'm talking about terrified. What the hell am I going to do? I got to raise three kids who just lost their dad. Holy shit. And I went to morning meditation, and God loved Joyce Pruitt. She said, honey, sit down. I'm going to get you some coffee. Okay, this is good. I was just shaking. And we started reading, and she looked over at me, and she said this to me. She said, yeah, what is the problem? She said, you're going to do what you did yesterday, tomorrow, and you're going to do what you've done every day since then, and y'all are going to figure out how to get through this, and you're going to walk your path. That's how you're going to do it. And we're going to pour you in a cup, and we're going to bring you to meetings, and we're going to, you know, do what we got to do. And we'll bolster you, and we'll hold you up, and we'll scotch tape you together, and we'll yell at you, and we'll do all kinds of things. Well, we'll keep you in the loop, and we'll keep you moving. That's what you have done for me. Over and over and over again. And you have loved me despite my defects of character. And I will say this. You know, there are a lot of people that stroll in these rooms and have the arrogance of, hey, thank y'all, y'all saved my life, I'm out now, I'm good, I got this. Number one, I was taught that is the height of arrogance for you to come here and these people to save you, and then you'd be like, see you bitches, I'm good. There's no sobriety in that. There's no message in that. We come back for two reasons. I'm no guru. And listen, I am not sitting on the top of a mountain by any stretch of the imagination. I still come to meetings for me. If I can help you in the process, awesome. But I bring my ass here to treat this alcoholic. Because though I've been sober 36 years, it does not mean I am well. By any stretch, just ask my kids. They'll be the first one that I am, but she's not. But we stay here. And out of this, for me, this program has been my foundation. There is nothing in my life that has not come out of it. Because I have, the one thing that I have taken your experience on is that if I drink again, it's over. I will let every alcoholic that picks up another white chip teach me that lesson over and over again. There's nothing out there. So I come back because everything in my sobriety, everything in my life today is a result of showing up here and doing those things and being a part of. That's it. It's real simple. Don't drink. Don't drink. Go to meetings. Have a sponsor. Now, I will say, girls, when you get some time under your belt, the number of women that have a lot of sobriety gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. So what we have done to combat this issue is I have a group, there are four of us that are like running buddies. Okay, we all sort of sponsor each other. Probably not the best, but that's what we do. And we've known each other long enough to be like, girl, stop, because you're fixing to do that, and you know what's going to happen. Okay. I have given this program permission to take my inventory. And I have given certain permissions in this program for them to be brutal about it. Because that's how I learned. When somebody said, sit down and shut up because you don't know what you're talking about, and get busy. Okay, cool. I can do that. The gifts that have come out of staying sober, I have three beautiful children. They are 31, 29, 26. I did an 11.5-month-old granddaughter. That is the cutest thing on the face of the earth. What a blessing she is. I have a husband. We married about, if you know Russ, he's a real quiet guy. Russ is kind of like a Timex. Russ is one of those people, they just tick, they just tick, tick. Tick, nothing changes, nothing rocks them, and I'm like, if you have the opportunity to get someone in your life that's in recovery, I highly recommend it. What I've been given here, and I want to wrap up in the next 5 minutes or so, is that when you've been sober 36 years, there's a lot of shit that's happened. Some really cool stuff and some really fucked up stuff too. The world has blown apart. There are things that you never counted on, but there's some things that don't change. And one of the things that don't change that I've learned is, number one, I am not a good arbiter of the prediction of the events that have happened in my life, because you know what? There are some things that have happened that I've been like, God, yeah. That's the best thing that could happen that turned out to be a disaster and cost a whole lot of money and a lot of time. I've had some things happen that I thought, oh my God, that's the worst thing that could ever happen that turned out to be best. So my job and my deal with God is to just do what's in front of me and leave the results to Him. And here's the point. The point is, there's no advanced AA. There's no back room that when you get a certain point, then they'll let you in the back room, and they'll open the golden book, and then you'll be revealed the secrets. And you'll get the secret handshake, and you'll get the ring, and you'll get the do-do, and you'll get whatever reward there is. No, the shit I do today to keep me sober, it is exactly the same thing I did when I got sober. So guess what? Learn it first. Learn it when you get here, because it's really hard to have double-digit sobriety and you feel and think and act like a newcomer, And people look at you like, you've been sober 15 years and you behave in that way? Because that's the only, I learned that's the only thing I can change. I cannot change how I think. I cannot change how I feel. I can change how I behave. And I have spent a long time working on my behavior. Because I understand that it is when I behave soberly, it's amazing. There's some good things that happen in my life. When I don't behave soberly, yeah, shit gets fucked up pretty quick. And generally it's ugly. And there's that one thing that I like to avoid at all costs. Consequences. Consequences. It took me a long time to understand there's a connection between my behavior and the consequence. Did y'all know they're interrelated? They're interrelated. I can still behave poorly sober and still have negative consequences. It really boils down to this. We don't drink today. That's what we do. If I don't drink, then I have every opportunity to fix whatever I broke, to solve whatever problem is looming largely in my world that's terrible and the whole thing is going to blow up. I do it today. That's it. That's the key. That's the secret. If you don't drink, amazingly, your world doesn't fall apart and you don't end up with all those things. You know, and I do want to say this. I start my story and I talk about being inherently dishonest because alcoholic thinking doesn't change much, guys. I'm telling you, I don't know about y'all, but my screwed up thinking is still there. Because we have this dramatic, extreme thinking. You know, I had a headache about a couple weeks ago. Right? And it went up for like 3 days. So, you know, I'm driving down the road, and in my mind, I have a brain tumor. I'm going to die. That's it. I need to just make sure that all these things. Did we think some that shit? That doesn't go away just because we're sober. Why? Because the problem is, the book tells us, the bottle was but a symptom. The problem is me. And if I'm the problem, I cannot be the solution. Those two things can't live in the same house. So I come here because you guys offer the solution. There's a three, I don't hear this very often anymore, but it's important and I'll end on this. Alcoholics Anonymous is a three-legged stool. It's God, it's me, and it's y'all. Because if I could have figured out how to stay sober with just God, I would have done that shit. I tried. I didn't drink, but I got nuts, and I had a lot of consequences. And if I could stay sober with just me and y'all, I tried that too. Didn't work out well, not so much. But the way in my world that it works is that I talk to God. God distributes the information that I need to hear to y'all. I come to meetings, I talk to other alcoholics on the phone or in my life, and God delivers what I need to hear through you, because sometimes y'all are God with skin on. That's how my three-legged stool works. So thank y'all for keeping me sober, and thank you for letting me tell my story tonight.
Mary, thank you. Honest to God, best talk I've heard in a very, very long time.
You took a rolling stop through the old playground. It ain't what you thought, but look at what you found. The beautiful thing that you love so hard, just an old newspaper blowing across the yard. stop when you put your foot in the door when you can't come in. Empty glass, shady past, you'll find some time. And it's strange how you change. You know about his problem now. You know about his problem now. Well, the angel's arms are full of holes. She walks it off outside where it's nice and cold. There's a sad soul song that you used to share. There's a vacant space where you used to care. You're a spark in the dark, hey, you burn somehow. On your way, like they say. You're nobody's problem now. Nobody's problem now. When the sun comes up, we'll still be here. When we've had enough, we'll still be here. When the flame is blown, we'll still be here. When it all comes home, we'll still. There's weeds in the walk where the home place leans. Cattails crying in a dried up stream. You take a long deep breath and blow it out slow. You bring the same old shadow everywhere you go. You're far.